Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
They were invisible. They had been kept at home. Our goal was to end that.
It's the 50th anniversary of the law that created special education as we know it. We take stock of where things stand now and look to the future.
For Wednesday, December 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, a look at the Pentagon press corps, now filled with members handpicked by the Trump administration.
I'm concerned that there is so much damage being done by Pete Hegseth.
And the president says he wants Somalis in the U.S. to leave.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country's no good for a reason. Their country stinks.
We hear from Minnesota, home to the country's largest Somali community.
And the latest in our Here to Help series. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Federal agents launched a long-expected immigration enforcement sweep today in New Orleans. Immigration lawyers say they have been flooded with calls. It's the latest area targeted by the Trump administration's campaign to step up arrests and deportations of immigrants who don't have legal status in the country. NPR's Martin Costi has more.
Well, so far the feds are promising something similar here. They say they're going after people who are in the country illegally and have committed crimes. And in New Orleans, they say that means looking for people with criminal histories who are let out of the local jail but not turned over to ICE. That's what the feds want local jails to do, turn those people over if they're in the country illegally. Trump has been highly critical of what he calls sanctuary policies, which he says protects criminals from being deported. But all that said, this operation probably won't focus only on criminals, because what we've seen in other operations, such as in Chicago, is that most of the people who were swept up on immigration violations did not have criminal records.
NPR's Martin Costi reporting. The House Judiciary Committee has subpoenaed former Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith to testify at a deposition later this month. The Republican-led panel wants to question him about his investigations of President Trump. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The House Judiciary Committee is subpoenaing Jack Smith to provide documents and to appear for a deposition on December 17th. The panel's Republican chairman, Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, says in a letter that lawmakers believe Smith has information that is vital to its oversight of the Justice Department and Smith's investigations. Smith had previously offered to testify publicly before the committee. In a statement, his attorney, Peter Kosky, says Smith is disappointed the committee rejected that offer and instead has subpoenaed him for a closed-door deposition. Still, he says Smith looks forward to speaking with lawmakers to, quote, clarify the various misconceptions about his investigation. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins says she'll announce an aid package next week for soybean and other commodity farmers. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports many are on the brink of bankruptcy due to inflation and President Trump's trade war.
Farmers have been ramping up the pressure on the White House after the harvest. Millions of tons of soybeans are sitting in bins across the Midwest since China has been buying instead from Brazil amid a heated trade war. At the president's cabinet meeting, Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins told Trump that next week she'll announce, quote, bridge payments to farmers to keep them afloat as trade negotiations continue.
For so long, our farmers, many of them have been farming for government checks instead of moving their product around the world. These trade deals change that forever.
The White House says China has committed to buying 12 million tons of soybeans this year. That's less than half of what they bought last year. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Derek Liu is officially San Francisco's new police chief. Mayor Daniel Lurie appointed the San Francisco native to the post this afternoon. Liu has worked for the department for nearly 20 years, most recently serving as deputy chief. He will replace interim police chief Paul Yep. Public safety advocates with the group Stop Crime SF say they're pleased with the selection. Here's Frank Noto, president of the local anti-crime group.
He's going to be a community-oriented police chief, interacting and communicating with everybody from neighborhood associations to small merchants groups. and is going to be answerable to the committee.
Liu was previously captain of the city's Ingleside Station and a commander for the city's Drug Market Agency Coordinating Center. California has launched a new online tool to track unlawful conduct by federal agents using civilian reports. State Attorney General Rob Bonta says the portal is a necessary response to reports of unmarked vehicles in abduction-style arrests.
When Californians witness conduct that looks unlawful, excessive force, unnecessary detentions, unconstitutional searches, they deserve a place to report it, a place where their information is taken seriously. This portal helps us do just that.
Residents can upload photos, videos, and other information. The Attorney General's office says it can't provide legal advice to those who submit complaints, but will use the data to track patterns and for potential legal action. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and from the listeners of KQED. The traditional press corps at the Defense Department has been replaced by far-right media personalities. A report on the transition and its potential impact is ahead in the next part of All Things Considered. Support for KQED comes from Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at aseasontosparkle.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 50 years ago, just after Thanksgiving 1975, President Gerald Ford signed a landmark law that created special education as we know it. Well, for the next few minutes, we're going to mark its 50th anniversary by taking stock of where things stand today, as the Trump administration has tried to make significant cuts to federal staff who support and protect students with disabilities. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner joins us now. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Elsa.
So can we just first talk about what things were even like for students with disabilities before this landmark law even came down?
In 1970, federal data shows that public schools educated just one in five children with a disability, Elsa. I spoke with Ed Martin. He's now 94, and he helped write that landmark law that changed that.
Mostly, it was just that they were invisible. They had been kept at home. Our goal was to end that.
So before the law passed, Martin helped organize public hearings for parents so they could share their stories directly with lawmakers.
There was one mother who told us a story about the school bus stopping at the foot of her driveway and her daughter standing in the window crying, saying, "Why can't I go with the other kids?"
Ultimately, Elsa, Congress listened. They passed what we now know as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. Mm-hmm. And the very next school year, it helped some 3.7 million students.
Wow. Okay, and what does it mean that this law helped all of those millions of students? Like, what changed for them precisely?
Yeah, the law guarantees children with disabilities the right to a free, appropriate public education. That means schools have to provide accommodations. They're also required to keep kids in traditional classrooms as much as possible. To help pay for it, Congress sends states billions of dollars every year. And then finally, the Education Department provides oversight through its Office of Special Education Programs, which fields calls from families, and it makes sure states follow the law.
And what if parents worry that a school is falling short, or even worse, actually discriminating against their child?
They can file a disability discrimination complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, or OCR. Now, its authority does not come from IDEA, but there tends to be a lot of overlap. And if OCR sees something concerning about how a child has been treated at school, its attorneys can open an investigation, and there's no need for a family to hire an expensive lawyer or advocate.
Well, as we said, we know that the Trump administration has made deep cuts across the Education Department. How might those cuts affect the federal role in special education, you think?
Yeah, in several ways. The Office for Civil Rights lost about half its staff in spring layoffs. And then during the shutdown, the administration fired most of those who were left. They also fired nearly everyone at the Office for Special Education. Now, those shutdown cuts, Elsa, have since been reversed, but there's no guarantee the administration won't try to make them again. President Trump has also said he wants to move special education to a different agency. In defending all of this, Education Secretary Linda McMahon has said she does not want to cut special education funding. Instead, what she wants to cut is, quote, the centralized bureaucracy micromanaging what should be a state-led responsibility, she says.
Well, Corey, you said the Office for Civil Rights now has about half the staff it had in January, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean for parents filing disability discrimination complaints then?
To answer that question, Elsa, I want to introduce you very quickly to one family I met. They live in a Kansas City suburb, Maggie Heilman and her daughter Brooklyn, who's in eighth grade. Brooklyn has Down syndrome, which also affects her speech. She loves playing basketball, she told me, also dancing. She and her mom talked about how Brooklyn's favorite hot lunch at school is chicken nuggets with mashed potatoes.
Yum.
After a mall,
second. Oh my, I knew you got second.
Doesn't it? That mom likes my potatoes.
You like to dip the mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
I do too.
Now, in October 2023, Maggie Heilman told me she got a call from Brooklyn School that her daughter had become agitated and was secluded for 20 minutes in a small padded room. Now, schools sometimes turn to seclusion when a student poses a risk to themselves or others. It is allowed in many states, but it can also be traumatic. And Heilman says she told school staff that she opposed the use of seclusion with Brooklyn. After that, she says the school used a kind of informal seclusion.
And we just saw our daughter's health physically, mentally, emotionally deteriorate.
And then finally, Brooklyn switched schools and things immediately turned around for her. But Heilman says she worried for the students who came after her. So she filed a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, OCR, arguing that Brooklyn had been denied her legal right to a free, appropriate public education.
And what happened with that complaint?
Well, an attorney at OCR opened an investigation, we know that, just over a year ago. But since then, Heilman has had two different OCR attorneys who both appear to have gotten caught up in the administration's mass firings. Heilman hasn't heard anything new about her case in months. In a statement, the department told NPR, quote, we are rebuilding and refocusing OCR to enable the office to protect students and enforce the law. But Elsa, public data suggest OCR is shifting away from these kind of labor-intensive, disability-related investigations. Since Trump took office, it has reached resolution agreements in 73 disability cases. But compare that to the first year of Trump's first term in 2017. Instead of 73, OCR reached agreements in more than 1,000 such cases.
Wow, that's a huge difference. Well, considering how 50 years ago things were really hard for kids with disabilities, how does that compare with where things are now?
I mean, look, IDEA now reaches more than 8 million children, giving them educational opportunities that kids with disabilities simply did not have before this law existed.
Yeah.
And that is a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now we're just in a moment of change, or at least uncertainty. You know, the message from the Trump administration is the money that comes with IDEA should keep flowing to states, but that states can handle the rest without much federal oversight. And frankly, the last time families really had to rely solely on their states was before 1975, when this law was passed.
That is NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Thank you so much, Corey.
You're welcome, Elsa.
This week, the Pentagon unveiled its new press corps, mostly right-wing outlets handpicked by the Trump administration to cover the Trump administration. You may recall that back in October, established media organizations, including NPR, walked out after refusing to comply with new rules. For an update on who is asking questions at the Pentagon now, I want to bring in Steve Walsh, who covers the military for WHRO in Norfolk. Hey there, Steve.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Let's go back for a sec to the origins of all this. It was a pledge, and the Pentagon wanted all Pentagon reporters to sign it.
Right, right. So the vast majority of outlets from Fox News to the New York Times to NPR refused to sign a pledge that basically said they would not report on anything that was not officially authorized by the Department of Defense, which this administration now calls the Department of War. Shortly after that happened, the Pentagon announced a new group of mainly right-wing outlets, which they say replaces the traditional press corps. These include bloggers and talk show hosts, many of whom have never covered the Defense Department, and many of them were actually asked by the Pentagon to become members of this new press corps. The group that showed up this week included former Congressman Matt Gaetz, who had briefly been President Trump's nominee for Attorney General. He now has a show on the One America News Network, and Laura Loomer, who is a conservative activist with deep ties to the White House.
Now, the Pentagon has not held very many on-camera briefings with reporters, not since Trump took office again back in January. This week, that changed. Tell me more.
Yeah. So starting Monday, they have been getting an orientation. Many of these people don't live in Washington. The media area has been largely vacant since the walkout in October. They posted videos on social media from the Pentagon briefing room, which had been off limits to the press corps for months. Yesterday, Deputy Press Secretary Kingsley Wilson gave her first on-air, on-camera briefing since becoming coming on board in January. Wilson herself has been accused of previously making anti-Semitic posts before she was brought into the Pentagon. She spent a fair amount of time railing against the mainstream media. Now, the questions were a mixed bag. One outlet did ask about when the Pentagon would produce the intelligence to justify the lethal strikes against the boats in the Caribbean. Others adopted the taunt "seditious six" that Secretary Hegseth uses to describe the group of Democratic lawmakers who urged troops not to follow unlawful orders. I spoke with the last deputy Pentagon press secretary under the Biden administration, Sabrina Singh. She worries that this new group is part of a larger politicization of the military.
I'm concerned that there is so much damage being done by Pete Hegseth. There will one day be another Secretary of Defense. Whoever that person is going to have to contend with the fact that we have so deeply politicized service members, and I don't know how you undo that damage.
Well, and just practically speaking, Steve, how is all this changing how you, how other defense reporters are doing their jobs?
Well, I mean, as we know, the lack of access has not stopped the flow of stories coming out of the Pentagon. People are still talking, people are still working their sources, and they're still doing their job. Several outlets did ask for access to the press conference, but they were denied, so it doesn't look like people are going to be getting in the building on a regular basis. We're told the new group met today with Secretary Hegseth, who has only given two on-camera briefings himself at the Pentagon.
And who is very much in the hot seat for all kinds of things right now. WHRO's Steve Walsh, thanks very much for your reporting.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
After blistering attacks by President Trump on the Somali community, people in Minneapolis and St. Paul are defending Somali Americans. That story is next on All Things Considered after your traffic update starting in the North Bay. Here's Julie Deppish.
Here we're looking at that wreck, eastbound 37. This is after Skaggs Island Road. A car and a pickup truck blocking that lane, a really jammed back to Sonoma Creek Bridge. Pleasanton wreck on westbound 580 at Hopyard Road. Two-minute lanes are blocked here, so that's backing up to Santa Rita. And trouble in Oakland on south 880 at High Street. Big rig and a car in the second lane for the left. Your traffic is crawling back to Fifth Street. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie, we'll have another update in 10 minutes. Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy, protecting beloved Bay Area parks like Crissy Field, Marin Headlands, Land's End, and more. Learn how to keep these parks welcoming for all at parksconservancy.org. And from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, launching the Community Lifeline Fund, a response to public policy shifts endangering low-income residents' access to essential services. Info about supporting the fund at svcf.org.
Clipper is coming out with a bunch of new features this month, and they're designed to save riders money and modernize how they pay for transit. I wrote a guide about the changes that are coming to Clipper, including discounted transfers for people that switch from one transit agency to another, and updates to how people can add value to their Clipper cards. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, and I'm a reporter for KQED. You can find my guide on kqed.org/explainers.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening? Plastics. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6:30 here on KQED. Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez in movie theaters starting December 5th. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the listeners of KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. About 80,000 people of Somali descent now call Minnesota their home. Almost all of them are U.S. citizens. And yesterday, President Trump attacked Somali immigrants in racist and xenophobic terms.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Okay? Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country is no good for a reason. Their country stinks.
The mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul spoke up to defend their Somali community. They also responded to reports that the Trump administration is targeting that community with extra immigration enforcement. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio joins us now with more from St. Paul. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
So what seems to have prompted Trump's statements there?
Well, let me say first that Trump and Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz have been at odds since last year when the governor was former Vice President Kamala Harris's running mate on the Democratic presidential ticket. At a cabinet meeting yesterday, the president attacked the Somali American community here in response to a question about widespread fraud in Minnesota's social service programs during the Walz administration. And here is some context. Since late 2022, federal prosecutors here have charged 78 people connected to a nonprofit called Feeding Our Future with stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from taxpayer-funded child nutrition programs. The convicted ringleader, Amy Bach, is white, but the majority of the defendants in this case are of Somali descent, and most are naturalized U.S. citizens. Trump went on to call Somali Americans, quote, garbage, including one of his fiercest critics, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. The Minneapolis Democrat responded, saying, quote, his obsession with me is creepy. And to be clear, neither Walz nor Omar have been implicated in the fraud investigation.
Well, Matt, as we mentioned, there have been several reports that the Trump administration is going to target undocumented Somali immigrants in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So what have city leaders said about that?
Well, they were quick to respond. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey denounced the president's comments and said that Somali immigrants have been a key part of the community's fabric for decades. Many are not immigrants. They're second-generation Americans who were born here. Frey said that immigration officials are at major risk of violating the community's constitutional rights.
When people are arrested by federal immigration agents, they're going to get the wrong people. They're going to screw it up so badly that they're not just violating habeas corpus, but they are taking away the rights of American citizens.
Now, Mayor Melvin Carter of St. Paul was with Frey yesterday at a news conference and echoed those comments.
Who he just attacked isn't just Somalis. Who he attacked is Somali Americans. Who he attacked is Americans.
And what about leaders in the Somali community? Like, what kind of responses are you hearing from them to all of this?
Jelani Hussein, who leads the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations and was born in Somalia, came here as a child, said today that the community has reported already seeing an increased presence of immigration and customs enforcement personnel in the Twin Cities. He also said he's received reports of American citizens being asked about their citizenship. Hussein says this is blatantly discriminatory.
Weaponizing ICE to target black Somali immigrants. This is not immigration policy. This is racism being directed from the president's office.
Well, when it comes to local law enforcement, Matt, did police say how they will respond if there is an uptick in immigration enforcement there?
Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara says his department does not enforce federal immigration law, but he did say if there are demonstrations that become violent, police are required to respond to protect public safety.
That is Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik. Thank you so much, Matt.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on this program, we'll take a look at the Border Patrol's aggressive immigration operation in Charlotte, North Carolina. The week-long operation took the city by surprise, and immigrants and other residents say that their city will never be the same. The economic costs are still rippling throughout the city. Meanwhile, the immigration crackdown caused an outpouring of solidarity among some residents. Hear more tomorrow on All Things Considered.
Immediately after Hurricane Helene flooded western North Carolina in September of last year, neighbors helped neighbors get supplies, operate generators, and reach safety. But many people wanted to do more. As part of our series on volunteerism, here to help, Zachary Turner from member station WFAE brings us this report on western North Carolina's first volunteer emergency response team.
After Helene, Black Mountain resident Chris Kepler sprung into action, using her chainsaw to clear debris.
One of my neighbor's tree fell down across her entire front yard. It blocked her in. She was on oxygen. And, of course, we didn't have power or anything. And I wasn't quite sure how I would get hold of first responders because the 911 system was down.
The town's emergency communications had failed, along with their backup radio system. As a former Marine, she felt she could help.
There were a lot of people that wanted to do more, but we weren't trained.
Other residents were in the same boat. They wanted to help, but couldn't. Many had skills that the town could have really used, like Wendy Coins.
As a newly retired family doctor, I felt like there wasn't any organized way for me to help.
So you wanted to help, but
so
you just
I wanted to help, and it was really hard, and we had no set systems in place prior to the disaster for community members just to jump in.
So they decided to start the town's Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT. They spent the last several months training with first responders on disaster communications and preparedness. Now, 28 residents can help with evacuations, traffic control, supply distribution, and other tasks. They got their first assignment during a Halloween event. About 3,000 kids go door-to-door on two blocked-off streets near downtown. It's a big deal in a small mountain community of roughly 9,000. Kepler staffed one of two reunification tents.
We're assisting with lost kids, and so we can communicate between our team and by putting out a description of the child or the parent, if the parent got lost from the child.
Tonight, Kepler and her fellow CERT members get a good lesson on using their new emergency radios. Another volunteer radios Kepler.
What members will be in each group, please?
And Victor 215.
They're trying to use their Victor numbers,
Alpha,
Victor for volunteer,
talking,
instead of names.
Volunteer firefighter David Billstrom has been training the CERT members on the do's and don'ts of using these radios.
So you have to press the button to talk and hesitate for just a minute. The rule is half a second, and then start talking.
Halloween night was a certified success, according to Billstrom. The team reunited four kids with their parents and greatly improved their radio skills. And for Kepler, she feels more prepared.
I always wanted to know, was there more that I could have done? So this gives me the skills to hopefully continue to educate my neighbors, first and foremost, and my family, and make sure that we're ready, and then to be able to help the community at large.
In the meantime, Kepler and the other volunteers will keep training and refining their radio etiquette. For NPR News, I'm Zachary Turner in Black Mountain.
This is NPR News.
The Commerce Department's decision to slap heavy duties on Italian pasta could cause it to double in price in the U.S. That story is ahead in the next part of All Things Considered. KQED News with Natalia Navarro is coming up after your traffic update. Here's Julie Deppish.
And big delays on the Nimitz Freeway with that crash in Oakland on South 880 at High Street. Got a big rig and a car on second lane for the left. Traffic crawling back to 5th Street. Out in Fairfield, eastbound 80 before Air Base Parkway, that crash involves a minivan, not blocking but slow from West Texas. And up in Sonoma County, there's a crash on South 101, the off-ramp to downtown Santa Rosa. Couple cars, both on the right shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Good Earth Natural Foods, serving the Marin community with organic holiday meals, turkeys, and more, with locations in Fairfax and Mill Valley, now offering curbside pickup and delivery. Learn more at genatural.com. And from visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. It's 5:30.
From KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Tomorrow, teachers in the West Contra Costa Unified School District are starting an open-ended strike amid stalled negotiations on staffing and wages. Impasses have also been declared in the Oakland Unified and San Francisco Unified Districts, meaning more strikes could be coming next year if contract agreements aren't made. For more on these school labor issues, I'm joined now by EdSource reporter Lewis Friedberg, host of Education on the Line podcast. These are not new issues. We know school districts around the country and specifically here in the Bay Area are facing budget crises, while teachers' unions say current pay and staffing levels make it impossible to keep good teachers in the classroom. But how did we end up with this confluence of big local districts without current contracts with teachers all at once?
There's 1,000 school districts, plus or minus, in California. Every one of those districts negotiates a separate contract with their local union. So at any point, there's hundreds of districts around the state that are in the process of negotiating a contract. This year, 32 districts, all affiliated with the California Teachers Association, were able to align their contract ending on June 30th. For many of them, and this includes Oakland, San Francisco, West Contra Costa, those three districts I mentioned, they were in labor negotiations, reached an impasse. They are now negotiating those contracts. Part of the problem is the situation is even worse than it was before. In terms of the rising costs in California, we all know that cost of living has just gone, you know, through the roof in California. School districts are feeling those rising costs, as are teachers and other employees. And then on top of that, there's the issue of declining enrollments. Birth rates in California are declining. A growing number of kids are in charter schools, which means the school districts don't get the funds that they might have gotten for those kids. All these factors are creating an extremely difficult situation for both sides.
How does the statewide push to align contracts influence bargaining power at the district level? Is it actually helping teachers get what they need, or is it affecting the likelihood of compromise?
We are going to see how all of this plays out, because this is the first time this has been done. The California Teachers Association has helped launch this campaign called We Can't Wait. The goal really was to try to put a kind of collective pressure on school districts to become more aware of the plight of teachers. I do think that an agreement that's reached in one district will kind of set the bar for what other districts with unions in other districts will try to negotiate with their districts.
Is there a way out of this loop of strike threats and then lackluster agreements and then strike again?
Well, you know, one of the things that everybody says, the state has to pay more money because the schools are not revenue-making bodies. However, the state already pays approximately 40% of its general fund. At the moment, there's no real likelihood that the state is going to come up with additional funds. It's kind of a tragedy that here you have teachers fighting with former teachers to divide up a pie that's really shrinking because of rising costs.
What will you be watching out for as the West Contra Costa strike begins tomorrow?
When will the two sides come to the negotiating table? What kind of compromises will they be able to make? How deep will districts be willing to dig into their budgets?
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was EdSource reporter and host of the Education on the Line podcast, Lewis Friedberg, and I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, offering a platform to assist teams build APIs to help API agents make decisions. Postman.com. Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Rep, presenting Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, a ghost story told by Jefferson Mays, a special one-week engagement through December 21st. More info at berkeleyrep.org. And from Second Harvest of Silicon Valley, providing nutritious food to 1 in 6 people in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties. Learn more at shfb.org. And this week in KQED Arts, arts editor Sarah Hotchkiss reflects on the best art she saw but didn't yet write about this year, plus a guide to the latest crop of holiday movies. That's at kqed.org/arts. And support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. And from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com, and from the listeners of KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Israel has tested all kinds of new weaponry in the last 2 years of war. This week, it revealed some of that technology and other weapons it has created for future wars. Despite a global outcry over the huge civilian death toll in Gaza, Israel is selling the tech to other countries. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
A lot of the military tech on display this week at an expo at Tel Aviv University looked like something out of a sci-fi movie, like a new high-powered laser that looks like a huge camera lens.
This is the turret from our system called Iron Beam.
Ari Sasher from the Israeli arms manufacturer Rafael. Israel says it will begin to deploy the Iron Beam by the end of the month. The laser can knock rockets, mortars, and cruise missiles out of the sky.
It takes a very powerful beam of light. We heat the target, we deep fry it, and then the target blows up by itself.
When the Gaza war broke out following a Hamas attack 2 years ago, the military began using all kinds of new drones for surveillance and targeting. Daniel Almog's company, Eyes Atop, provides the Israeli military, the IDF, with handheld screens that soldiers use to coordinate multiple kinds of drones.
So that any new drone the IDF wants to introduce, the pilot can fly on day one like a Jedi.
A screen on display shows a recording of a flight over a Palestinian village in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Almog explains what the system can do.
You want to close the kill chain with a single operator. So through our orchestration system, you can call in a kamikaze drone or a heavy lift strike drone like this to drop munition on the target.
Israel also began using unmanned vehicles on the ground in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria, made by a company called Otopia. They roll into enemy territory, scan and identify targets using AI, and keep the soldier out of harm's way, says founder Amit Rosenzweig.
He or she can drink coffee while using a joystick to control a tank or an APC or whatever it is that he or she needs to control to get the job done.
Palestinians in Gaza have posted videos like this one when a person spots a military robot on wheels.
Yama! That's a robot!
And videos of armored personnel carriers laden with explosives. Again, Rosenzweig.
Some videos were published where you can see something like a large vehicle, APC, that's the purpose of such vehicle is, yes, to go somewhere and explode, not necessarily to take down a building, but maybe take down a bad guy.
Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians have been killed, has drawn worldwide criticism, including accusations of genocide, which Israel rejects. Outside the expo, about 30 Israeli university students and faculty protested. Anthropology professor Ofra Goldstein-Gidoni.
The drones, which seems to be very high-tech and great, but basically
using AI, all this clever technology, many people were killed by drones. And the thing is that we are all complicit here in Israel.
To protest the war, some countries said they would restrict arms sales to Israel. But officials from more than 20 countries attended this Israeli Defense Expo, organizers say. Israeli Colonel Yishai Kohn says defense exports are soaring.
In general, Israel's export has been breaking its record for the past 3 years, each year in a row. And we expect that this year will end with a new record, too.
Israel's Aero defense system, which countered Iranian missiles this year, was deployed today in Germany, which sees Russia as a growing threat and sees this tech as essential. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Italian pasta could vanish from the grocery store shelves or at least double in price starting in January. That is if the Commerce Department goes ahead with the decision to slap heavy duties on imports from over a dozen Italian pasta brands. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports on the ongoing negotiations.
Since the 1800s, Italian pasta, fusilli, spaghetti, rigatoni, has been shipped across the Atlantic to be enjoyed by Americans.
Questa non è semplicemente una pasta.
It's not just pasta, says one advert for the Italian La Molisana pasta brand.
È una dichiarazione d'amore, tutta italiana. La Molisana.
It's an all-Italian declaration of love. Under the Trump administration, though, this declaration is being well and truly spurned, and the fight for Italian pasta is now national news. Here's NBC's Today.
Americans could soon be saying arrivederci to their favorite Italian pastas. Imports from 13 Italian pasta brands, including favorites like Barilla and Rumo, are staring down a 107% tariff.
This whopping extra import cost is a combination of tariffs the White House placed on all goods coming from the European Union and a penalty of almost 92% imposed by the U.S. Department of Commerce on pasta brands accused of dumping practices. This is when a company sells goods abroad at a cheaper price than in its domestic market. American competitor pasta producers have long accused Italian pasta brands of doing this, triggering regular investigations by the Department of Commerce. But this time, the penalty is huge, and Italian pasta companies and economic experts don't understand why.
Our update analysis of Italian pasta trade shows no evidence of the pasta dumping behavior.
Chiara Donegani is a senior teaching fellow in economics at Aston University in the United Kingdom. She says Italian pasta trades on the idea of heritage and quality, and so sells at much higher prices than American pasta.
Pasta is an iconic product, the renowned, well-known element of the Mediterranean diet. This is not dumping, this is premium dining, we would say.
The U.S. Department of Commerce says it applied the penalty after two Italian pasta companies it contacted for review, Garofalo and La Molisana, didn't provide the full requested data, and the response included things like untranslated Italian words. The Commerce Department then decided to hit nearly a dozen other Italian pasta companies with the same punitive measures. Why is it doing this? The Department of Commerce didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. Donegani thinks.
Our interpretation is that the short answer is politics and not economics.
President Trump has been using tariffs as an economic weapon for many issues, from trying to bring manufacturing to the United States to applying political pressure on other countries. In Italy, the foreign ministry is now directly involved in the Italian pasta affair, and a special task force has been set up to handle it.
La situazione è quella di una trattativa in corso.
Lorenzo Bazzana from Coldiretti, Italy's trade association that protects Italian produce and food producers, explains negotiations are now underway. And the White House has said Italian pasta brands still have time to engage with the review before the duties are final. If the full duties were imposed, Bazzana says, it would be, of course, bad news for Italian pasta makers, for whom the US is the second largest export market. But they could find markets elsewhere.
Chi viene poi alla fine penalizzato è quel consumatore.
Who really loses out is the American consumer. The cost of their Italian pasta would skyrocket, or possibly, Bazzana says, they simply wouldn't be able to find it in shops anymore. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Some people spend their retirement playing golf. Others travel. In Philadelphia, the retirees and the Senior Environment Corps see themselves as watchdogs for the local environment. WHYY's Sophia Schmidt reports.
Bob Meyer is 71 years old. He retired from a career as a biology professor, but he still likes to keep busy.
The horrible lure of retirement is to do nothing. And, you know, that's no good because you just end up vegetating at home watching, you know, daytime TV, and I don't want to do that.
Instead, Meyer volunteers with the Senior Environment Corps in Northwest Philadelphia. The group of more than a dozen retirees take on projects like sampling the soil and testing the area's waterways for pollution. Today, Meyer is in a lab at a local college. He's looking through a microscope, counting tiny pieces of plastic, or microplastics, from a sample of creek water.
Okay, I got a pretty sharp view now.
He finds tiny pieces with jagged edges and thin plastic fibers.
Ah, got a thread, and it's pink, so I know it's plastic.
Altogether, Meyer finds dozens of pieces of microplastics in this one small sample of creek water.
I don't know how you get it out. I know how you stop it. You stop using plastic. But that's... we'll be pushing up the daisies before that stops.
It's not all counting plastics in the lab. Some volunteers wade into streams to collect water samples. Others teach kids how to identify aquatic critters. Meyer and fellow volunteer David Schogel say the group is always looking for new members to join.
Anything you're particularly looking for in people who join?
If they're breathing, we want them.
Schogel is 85 and a retired social worker. He sees the nearly three decades he's volunteered with the Senior Environment Corps as part of his legacy.
I'm not a wealthy fellow, and I don't have any money to leave behind to any groups or even my family. But I can leave a better world.
The group meets monthly at a senior center. That's where 74-year-old Eleanor Lundy Wade found out about it. She's a former health inspector and public health educator.
I said, there's seniors that love and do the environment. I said, I want to be one of them.
Fred Lewis helped found the group more than 30 years ago. At 98, he's the oldest member. He says the Corps has been testing water quality for years, but looking for microplastics is new. Lewis is old enough to remember back when plastic first became widely used.
I mean, it was something that was so new that people were just trying to get suggestions as how we can take advantage of it. And now it's how we can end it.
Lewis says some people might assume that the older you get, the less involved with society you become. But he hopes this group changes some minds.
At the count of three.
At the end of every meeting, the volunteers close by singing the Senior Environment Corps song. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Schmidt in Philadelphia.
We are tracking down pollution, and we wish we could do more. We are proud to bear the title of the Senior Environment Corps.
Yay! That was a good rendition.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The KQED News Quiz is coming up next, but first let's get your traffic update. Heading back to the North Bay, here's Julie Deppish.
It's a bad crash on Highway 37. This is at Skaggs Island Road. A car and a pickup truck involved. Now lanes are blocked in both directions. Eastbound backed up all the way to Lakeville Highway. Trying to clear that crash in Oakland on South 880 at High Street. A big wreck in a car. Second lane for the left. It's a crawl back to Fifth Street. And new trouble Pleasanton North 680 after Bernal. An SUV and a motorcycle take away the right lanes. Very slow from Castlewood. Julie Depp Schwartke, QED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite, and Julie will have another update in 10 minutes. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition, Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and an onstage blizzard. Runs December 5th to 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. And from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Well, NATO foreign ministers met in Brussels to talk about the Russian threat, but Secretary of State Rubio was absent. Details are coming up next on All Things Considered. Right now, it's time for the KQED News Quiz Question of the Day. And today's question is, last night's City Arts and Lectures broadcast featured author Salman Rushdie in conversation with whom? Submit your answers at kqed.org/radio-news-quiz for a chance to enter to win.
Prices for so many things have been soaring, but not computers. They've been getting cheaper for decades. Is that going to last? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition airs from 2 until 9 here on KQED News. I'm Michelle Hennigan, and the time now is 5:50.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. NATO foreign ministers met in Brussels just a day after the last round of U.S.-led peace talks took place in Moscow. There is no evident progress toward ending Russia's full-scale war on Ukraine. Terry Schultz reports that European leaders in both NATO and the European Union are redoubling efforts to provide military backup for both Kyiv and themselves.
Many foreign ministers arriving at NATO headquarters expressed gratitude to President Trump for trying to end the war. Secretary General Mark Rutte went even further.
There is only one person in the whole world who was able to break the deadlock when it comes to the war in Ukraine, and that is the American President Donald J. Trump.
Rutte says he and his team have been kept well informed about the proceedings, but no European representative has been present at the talks. Former Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielius Landsbergis finds that alarming and worse.
It is dangerous and it's humiliating because of what is being discussed is European security.
Landsbergis would like to see Europe stop hoping for an invitation to be by the U.S.'s side.
Instead of Europe begging for a place at the table, Europe should set its own table with a very clear proposals what Europe is going to do to help Ukraine. What measures are going to be used to do that, and what Europe is going to do to help Ukraine win the war.
Estonia's Foreign Minister Margus Sakna echoed those thoughts in Brussels.
We must actually decide what we are going to do in Europe. Putin cannot decide over us. And as well, U.S. Cannot make decisions instead of us.
One big decision Europe's debating is whether to use frozen Russian funds to help Ukraine. Across town from the NATO meeting, the European Commission proposed using about $100 billion worth of these immobilized assets as collateral for a loan to Kyiv, which would be paid back if and when Russia pays reparations for its destruction of Ukraine. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen laid out the legal and moral arguments.
And we can equip them with the means to defend themselves and to lead peace negotiations from a position of strength. And since pressure is the only language the Kremlin responds to, we can also dial it up. We have to increase the costs of war for Putin's aggression, and today's proposal gives us the means to do this.
Many European governments think this is a brilliant idea, a game changer in the struggle to finance Ukraine. But there's one key holdout from the country holding most of the assets. Belgian Foreign Minister Maxime Prévost says the Commission proposal does not adequately share the financial responsibility for what happens should Russia sue and win the right to get the money back.
It is not acceptable to use the money and leave us alone facing the risks. We demand that the risks Belgium is facing as a result of this scheme are fully covered.
Von der Leyen says she believes the new proposal will address all of Belgium's concerns. She hopes to have a deal in hand in 2 weeks when European Union heads of state and government hold their last summit of the year. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Even though the federal government shutdown ended more than 2 weeks ago, some federal employees are still recovering from its effects. They told KNAU reporter Adrian Scabaland about it at a special dinner for them hosted by an organization outside of Grand Canyon National Park.
Ashley Dickerson has worked at Grand Canyon National Park for 3 years. The federal government shutdown had impacts beyond just getting furloughed for 43 days and missing a couple of paychecks, affecting nearly every facet of her life.
The impacts of stress on your mental health, on your physical health, like on your relationships with family and friends, as they're checking in and trying to figure out, are you going to be moving back home in a month? Because, you know, have they fired you yet? And I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
Dickerson is at Plaza Bonita Restaurant in Tucson. It sits just south of the main entrance into the park. She and a couple of dozen other federal workers are enjoying a free meal of fried chicken and tamales, chips and salsa.
This is one way for us to show our support when the community has really been suffering.
Elizabeth Silks is the CEO of Grand Canyon Conservancy. It's the nonprofit partner of the park and is hosting a series of 12 free dinners for residents of Tucson and Grand Canyon Village. Many, but not all, are park employees.
We actually had 250 people at the last dinner, and what it tells us is that people didn't feel very valued who work in the park and the park communities, and a lot of this year has felt very personal.
First came the Trump administration's mass layoffs last spring. Then the shutdown meant about 9,200 National Park Service employees were furloughed. That's according to a Park Service estimate. It's unclear how many of the 500 people who work at Grand Canyon missed paychecks. Plaza Bonita manager Javier Rosas says it's nice to see locals back.
Normally here with us, Thursday was a local day that all locals inside of the park used to come with us. And now with this shutdown, there's no more Thursday. So we saw a big difference with that.
Elijah and Wyatt Gibson, who are in 8th and 6th grades respectively, sit in a booth with their mom. Their dad is on the park's trail crew and was furloughed.
He's been spending a lot of days not going to work, and money's been a little tight.
Yeah, the big problem has just mostly been the money, and we've been having a lot of troubles with that.
Their mother, Cassidy Gibson, says even as her husband receives back pay, their family hasn't come out unscathed.
We were able to tap into some savings, but we had to use our credit card more than we'd like. Definitely more than we'd like. So it was hard. You know, that's our livelihood.
For other Grand Canyon workers, the shutdown complicated already stressful situations. Kim Acker, who's worked for the Interior Department for 14 years, had an unexpected medical emergency days after the shutdown began.
I essentially ended up with a large blood clot in my brain. You know, I'm looking at tens of thousands of dollars in medical bills, and it really made me think, can I afford to be missing paychecks if I'm going to have these bills that are due?
Acker says it's left her unsure of her future and whether federal employment is reliable. And she's concerned another shutdown could be looming. The budget resolution only lasts until the end of January.
In another month or two, are we going to be without paychecks again? And to be literally told that we don't matter and that we're not important and that we're low productivity, I mean, why would I want to work for something like that?
Acker says the Grand Canyon Conservancy's events have helped her and others feel more valued, but it still doesn't fully relieve her anxiety about what the future holds. The Conservancy is planning 6 more dinners like this for federal employees and people who live in Tucson and Grand Canyon Village this month. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Scabland in Tucson, Arizona.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters December 12th. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE, price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org and from the listeners of KQED. Immigration sweeps in New Orleans started today. A look at the impact on daily life in that city is coming up after the newscasts and after KQED traffic starting in Millbrae. Here's Julie Depesh.
And big trouble here. We've got a three-vehicle pileup on South 101 at Millbrae Avenue, taking up the two left lanes, solid back up to the 380 interchange. Overturned vehicle in Walnut Creek on South 680 before South Main. That's in the right lane, slow back to Olympic. Still looking at the motorcycle wreck, Pleasanton on North 680 after Bernal. The right lane blocked, traffic very heavy back to Castlewood. Julie Depesh for KQED.
Julie's next update is at 6:18. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Thank you for listening to KQED.